say, first of all, I sent you a new syllabus. I sent it twice. First time was messy, so just take the second one. It reminds you that next Thursday we meet in Stewart Center 214 at noon during class time for Professor Weinfield's discussion. I ordered soda and cookies. It's incredibly expensive, so I also ordered a lot of cups. Don't grab a can, just open it and take a cup. Otherwise, it won't be enough, because there's going to be three classes in there, I think. And 214, Stewart Center 214, next Thursday, February 8th, 2007. Right? And I changed the syllabus to reflect that, so don't be reading what I... Unless you want, feel free to read, but I've shortened up the reading assignments, all right? And I know you're all devouring the entire book, but for the class, I'm only requiring certain pages. So there's a, next Tuesday, we'll do the Hesiod section from here, and we'll do the two historians, Herodotus and Thucydides, all right? So that'll get us ready for Thursday. That means I had to combine some stuff, so the Aeneid has been way shortened, and so is Ovid's Metamorphosis is short. All right? Any question on that? I also changed the end of the year a bit. So today I'm going to finish Oedipus, and I'm going to do Antigone. Okay, I'm going to just walk through this. This is the unfun day. But I think these are pretty good plays, and once in your life you should, walk through them. So, fun for me. I hope it's not... I open the window so you can stare outside as you drift off to sleep while I talk too much here today. And let's just think a little bit about tragedy in general. And you have a section from Aristotle's Poetics on where he discusses tragedy, and I've put that on the syllabus, so I'm going to talk about it later. And he tries to come up with a theory of plot, character, thought, diction, melody, spectacle. Those are the six aspects of any kind of fictional representation. And there, it's an interesting discussion because it works just as well for a film as it works for a play. Right? It works for almost any literary construction. So we'll be getting to that. And Aristotle wrote that as he was reading these tragedies, which again are written in the period 480 to 430, that 50-year period between the Persian invasion, which we're going to read about for Tuesday, and the beginning of the Peloponnesian War between Athens and Sparta, which kind of ends the glorious realm of the reign of Athens. Again, these plays are written in Athens. Greece was not a country, it was a collection of city-states. So you were not a Greek, you were an Athenian, or in these plays, a Theban. And Oedipus was actually brought up in another city called Corinth, which you might know from the New Testament, because it was a famous place for the prostitutes. Okay, that's why Paul sent the mission there, right? And Sparta was another city. So people identified with their cities, not with the states. Greece is a land of flat plains and high mountains. So a lot of mountains, and then you get some plains. And on those plains, remember, you can sort of maybe run a Homeric chariot, but you're probably not going to get very far. Or you sort of have to do something with it as you head up the next mountain. All right? We have a number of tragedies that survive. Aeschylus is supposed to have written 90. I think we have six of them. Somehow these things made it from ancient times. The Romans read these things, so they made copies. But even those tended to disappear. There was a famous library in Alexandria, Egypt, which was a great storehouse of manuscripts, and it burned down sometime in the 4th century. So a lot of stuff was lost. And scholars spend centuries piecing together some of these plays by little fragments they get elsewhere. Now, two of the plays we're not doing, I thought would worth mentioning here at the beginning. One of them is on page 722. I just want to look at that. We're only doing tragedies, but the Greeks wrote comedies too. And the great comic writer was Aristophanes. And he's interesting because in the comedies, comedy developed as an art form among the Greeks. Just to put it simply, there's two ways to be funny. I can make fun of you, okay? And that's a lot of comedians, that's what they do. They make fun of people or ideas or groups, right? It's just a kind of slander and people are hilarious. Or you can try and construct a drama based on certain personality, general personality flaws, which as Aristotle said, generally turns on the ridiculous. So it's really an intellectual jump to go from stand-up comedy of slandering people to constructing a plot where you're laughing sometimes, but you're also feeling good. You're getting some other emotion out of it, right? And in Greek tragedy, we see that. It's not a development you see all over the world. So that's why we read this stuff. But unfortunately, we're not doing any in this class, right? But I thought I'd tell you about one example, and that's Lysistrata, which is the play on this thing. And I just very, very briefly, it's you might want to read it sometime, or if you get a chance to see a production, it works really well. Even a high school production of Lysistrata, it can be very effective because the theme is so interesting. It's just real simply, it's that the Greek city, I think it's Athens, is Aristophanes is writing in the time of the Persian War against Sparta, and there were a lot of people against the war, but there are a lot of people for it because a lot of people just like to fight, right? That's what they do for a living. People like to, you know, strew death and destruction. They think it's just fine. Well, the women of, I think it's Athens, decide that they've just had it up to here with all the men always going off to fight because it makes for all kinds of problems in society. First of all, women don't get to fight, so they instantly become second-class citizens, right? You know, it's just... Just physically, most women are smaller than men, so you're going to lose in a hand-to-hand combat, which is what they were dealing with back then, you know, carrying a sword. Right? Occasionally, there might be a very large woman who's bigger than a lot of men, and you know that's the exception. But in general, right, it makes wars make for second-class citizenship for women. Plus, the men aren't at home. They're not earning money. They're not helping around the house. They're off, and when they go off to war, typically, an army that goes off to war is fooling around, all right? That, you know, that's just a fact, and when I was doing this 5 years ago, I was just waiting for the moment when all the sex scandals would start to break, because you cannot send an army anywhere without it happening, right? What's remarkable about the American adventure in Iraq is how little we get some horrible instances of it, but it's remarkably tame. I'm not so sure life around an army base is so tame. Okay, so the women don't like this because the men sort of go wild, and they're not like coming home, and there's very little love going on in the household, right? So it's lonely with all those guys out there. So to stop the wars, the women decide to have a protest against the men who are at home, and they all get together and they decide no more sex for anybody until the war is over. And they just withhold favors, right? And then by the middle of the play, the men are all bent double and walking around and groveling and everything and saying, please, 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 please. So it's very funny. And they have to come to some kind of resolution. That's the plot. You can't believe that a Greek guy wrote that, can you? But that's the plot of Lysistrata, right? So it's a funny play and worth seeing. And it certainly makes its point about the war. The other play here is that we're not doing is by Euripides. And it's the Medea. And that's on page 690. And if I didn't have anything to say, I'd play. I have a very good tape of this. I used to use it in freshman composition, but I don't want to waste class time playing a tape, but this is a play. It's a tragedy, not a comedy. But it's a more human tragedy. Aeschylus and Sophocles are very cosmic. They're talking about irony and destiny and character and death. stuff like that. Euripides is more down to earth. He's talking about anger, jealousy, and revenge. And the story here is of Medea, who's married to a guy named Jason of the Argonaut fame. Jason led the, and the in the back of this is the myth of the Argonaut, which is the name means something about ship or going to sea. And in the myth, if you looked at it as a myth, it's sort of the story of how the Greeks conquered the sea. Now, it said very early, if you learned to sail, you could go somewhere and get rich because you could trade. You could go find somebody with iron mines and bring it back, or you could get spices or whatever, or slaves, you know, that kind of thing. Well, the whole notion of trade is very unaristocratic, so it always has to be put in kind of romance terms. Otherwise, your brave soldier is no better than your mere shopkeeper. Okay, so instead of saying, I'm going off to get some tin alloy in eastern Turkey, they say, ah, I'm going to chase the golden fleece, okay, which is a giant ram skin. That's manly, all right? It's made of gold and will bring me instant wealth, because it's somehow manly to conquer your money, but, you know, to actually trade for it is something anybody can do. There's a bit of that in the Odysseus myth, too. So Jason takes this crew, which included Hercules, and he sails off for the Golden Fleece. And I think it's really interesting to remember, picture a map of Greece right here. Okay. Schematic map. We usually think, I think in your imagination, you think of, if you're going to sail from Greece to get the Golden Fleece, you'd probably head in which direction? Well, I think most of us think, well, I think I'll look in France. I'll go west, all right? Because we're Western-oriented today. But that's in fact, just the just dead wrong. Jason, and they went east, okay? Like I said, to eastern Turkey, through the Black Sea. Okay? Because there was, you know, there were 10 mines, and there was civilization and stuff like that. And the Black Sea sort of ends, and it's a crossroads with Persia and the northern, what's today Chechnya, if you're following anything going on in Russia, kind of wealthy area, decent climate and stuff like that. So that's where the Golden Fleece was located, in the east. And Jason goes there. Well, the trick is you have to win the Golden Fleece, he has to prove his cleverness, just like Oedipus, and he the fleece is inside a maze. And to get through the maze, no one can enter the maze. Right, which is kind of designed to show your cleverness. But the daughter of the king, Medea, thinks that Jason's a real hunk, and she shows him the trick of getting into the maze and getting the fleece. So he's real happy and very grateful to her, and he marries her, and he grabs her away from her home and brings her back to Greece. And in the play, he says, look, well, all right, so it's the first wife. Years later, well, you know what kind of guy Jason is, right? There's a vacancy in the crown. I think it's actually in Thebes, too. I can't quite remember. And there's a queen just ready for marriage. And Jason says, look, I've got to advance the family. You, Medea, are now goodbye. Jason wants a divorce so he can marry little Creusa, the daughter of Creon, actually. Okay, little Creusa, but she's rich, and we know, you know, what this guy's all about. Okay. Well, the play is sort of presented from Medea's point of view. That's why it's so interesting. You think of ancient Greece as all about men, but this is right. Just like Lysistrata, sort of from the women's point of view, so is Medea. And she ain't happy. Right. And just to sort of cut to the chase, she is really furious at Jason, and she wants revenge. And she first pretends to not let it bother her, and congratulates Creusa and sends her a gift of a very fine robe, but she's dipped it in some sort of sulfuric acid, so when she puts it on, she burns to death. All right, take that for your husband's secretary. Okay. And then she looks at her children, and she's at this point she kind of flips, right? So you kind of lose sympathy for her, but that, you know, that's what you mess around with this stuff. You got to look out, all right? And she sees Jason's features in her children's face. You remind your of your father, and she takes them and she dashes their brains out in a brick. Okay, and in some version, I think in the play, she then does the usual thing and chops them up into a nice pie and serves it to Jason. Okay, so he gets to eat his children. That's revenge, right? The story of the jilted wife. That's Medea. Well, maybe it seemed like Oedipus is nothing after that. Okay, but. And that's got a more spectacular plot, but these are the greater works of art, and unfortunately you got me pushing at works of art here instead of decent stories. So let's go back to Oedipus and walk through it. And I want to try and find a simple way to outline this, and I'm never sure I can quite do it. But let me move over here. If we have that crossroads in focus, right, and we have Thebes, and then down on the isthmus, which is the sort of Greek mainland, into the Peloponnese in Corinth, Oedipus kills Laius here at the crossroads, and the news is brought by a guy I want to call messenger number one. Back to Thebes, that Laius is dead, and that it was done by Thebes. Well, I'm already lost myself here. I hadn't thought about this. So yeah, there's a time shift. No wonder I have so much trouble. Well, anyway, there was a time, and I guess maybe that's part of the play, it's just fairy stuff. There was a time when the prophecy came to Thebes that the child of Laius and Jocasta would kill Jocasta and sleep with the mother, so the kid was exposed on the mountain, which is called the Citharon, all right? So and he was given to a shepherd to take to the mountain, right? So let's call him shepherd number one, right? Well, in the, what happened was another shepherd, the guy didn't expose him. He gave him, in fact, to another shepherd, okay, who we call shepherd number two, who took him to Corinth and gave him to a sort of childless couple there, Polybus and Merope, and they adopted the kid. But they didn't tell him he was adopted, right? And eventually, remember, Oedipus got the news as he told the story. Well, towards the end of the play, these people die. And a messenger comes to Thebes, okay, to bring the news that Oedipus, you know, is going to be king of Corinth because, you know, everybody thinks he's right. So there we go. We got messenger number one, shepherd number one, shepherd number two, and messenger number two. Right. Now Aristotle says that the key to a plot is recognition and reversal. We don't know much about plot, but you suddenly recognize the truth. And clearly the movement of this plot is Oedipus recognizing that he's not, in fact, the child of Corinth, but that he's the child of Thebes, and that he's in fact killed his father. So that's the big truth he recognizes. And the reversal takes place, is that that doesn't exactly, based on that news, he puts out his eyes because he feels so guilty. So that's what you would call a reversal, right? It's not exactly helping your career, it's reversing it, okay? But what makes the play so confusing, right? And I'm doing this first instead of afterwards. And what it makes it like certain horror films you see. You ever seen one of those horror films where there's like a woman stalking a guy, or let's say you've come up with better examples from this. Say you have a guy stalking a woman, and then he rips off the rubber mask, and it's a woman underneath, or the woman stalking, and she rips off the rubber mask, and it's a guy underneath. You ever seen a movie like that? No? I saw a really good one. It all happened on a train. If anybody finds this movie, it's sort of a perfect thing. I mean, it's so freaky, right, that the person isn't who he or she seems to be, right? Maybe, what's the one with Michael Douglas and Sharon Stone, where she, you know, she looks like she's just having a fling, but then she proves to be mad and boils the rabbit. Have you seen that one? All right, this is way before, yeah, it's like movies from the 80s. I guess you were just being born. Okay. What's that called? Not Sharon Stone? Someone, you know, some actress. Basic Instinct. Okay, that was sort of another Michael Douglas thing. Same idea. That he thinks she's actually the one who's trying to kill him. Right? Some guy gets knifed with a giant jagged blade, and then she turns out to be. So you're really surprised. Well, the big surprise is, if the plot goes, what the big decision by Oedipus is, once he learns that, once he's finally convinced, once he learns that there was the murder of Laius, which somehow he didn't know about, right, and it happened at a crossroads, and he realizes that he killed somebody at the crossroads, right? The whole play turns on his hope, all right, that it was. That it was a plural group of thieves that did it, not a thief. Because if it was thieves that killed Laius, then his murder, he hadn't in fact killed the guy. But if it was a thief, okay, then he's in trouble. So he makes the decision to push for the guy. They need to get messenger number one, who first carried the news. And in the latter part of the play, Oedipus insists on sending for this guy because he insists on finding the truth, right? Because he's worried about prophecies. And meanwhile, Jocasta is saying, don't even worry about prophecies. They're all wrong, okay? But he insists on it. And, well, let's maybe just leave it right there, okay? See if we can straighten this out. What's going to happen? Who's going to be exposed here? Can anybody figure it out right now? All right, so let's walk through for a while, and then this will sort out. We left the text here, page 'Chorus. The first chorus starting at line 169, where they call to death, and I said, I mean, this whole mess is really, this whole plot really makes you think about the limits of life, because the moral at the end of the story is that you count no man happy till he's dead. Oedipus has everything, and he loses everything, okay, including his eyes. Well, Oedipus takes action after the chorus, and if you turn to line 260, okay, he offers amnesty to the murderer. Remember, they've got to find the murderer of Laius, who was killed at the crossroads, it turned out, because there's this plague in Thebes, and the only way, the oracle said, the only way to get rid of it is to find the murderer and not let a polluted murderer live in your midst. Think, a sex criminal who has to register so he won't be next to the school. All right, that's closest we come today. Murderers can live in our midst, but not child molesters. Right. So there's something awful about him. And he says, look, whoever admits this, the important thing is not punishing this guy, it's getting him out of the city. So whoever did it, whoever admits the murder, I'm going to give you amnesty, I'm just going to exile you, I'm not going to murder you. And at line 280, he puts a curse on the guy. And curses are always incredibly powerful, right up through the Renaissance, for this whole course. For various reasons, which I haven't quite figured out, but audiences love them. Right? And here it creates an irony. Oedipus puts the official malediction curse. You may you die. Well, who is he cursing? Himself, unknowingly, right? So it's kind of fun, right? And that's in line 280. And he aims to curse at himself. Anyway, he then... then hearing about... let me skip that part. The leader of the chorus at line 322, skip over to that. The leader of the chorus says, yeah, but you know, if the issue is finding the killer, well, why doesn't Apollo tell us who it is? I mean, I really think the god who would know should let us know. All right? But since, you know, I can't control these gods, and Apollo is a particularly funny one, all right, he says, well, the next best thing would be to get a prophet, Tiresias, the blind prophet of Thebes, because these blind prophets, they know everything. So get him in here, Oedipus, and ask the guy who it is. Well, Tiresias comes in, and of course he does know who the killer is, and he knows it's Oedipus, but he's afraid to tell him. All right, this is just like Agamemnon. You don't mess with a guy because you'd be in trouble. So he starts at line 360 by quibbling on seeing the truth. How terrible to see the truth. Remember Cassandra and the Agamemnon, she could see it, but nobody believed her. Well, here Tiresias knows, and it's just going to get him into trouble. And so he refuses to reveal, line 374, he refuses to reveal the dreadful secrets. You see that line? Dreadful secrets, line 374. Well, this is wonderful. This whole play becomes very mythic, because Freud, in the 20th century, just loved this stuff. This notion, this is a play about dreadful secrets that we all have. Right? And the whole thing about Freudian psychology was that you have an unconscious where you have all your filthy desires are repressed, okay? Because you live in a civilized world that won't let you do all the things you want to do. I went to Kiel, I went to Woom, right? Okay? And you just got to behave. You can't, you're not a tiger in the, you know, the wild. You're a person in a city. So, Freud read this whole political drama in terms of a psychological allegory. Very powerful effect, but we won't dwell on that, but it comes up a couple of times here. Well, when Tiresias refuses to reveal the secret of who the murderer is, at line 395, Oedipus is furious. Why won't you? You must be a traitor. You must have done it, he says to Tiresias. And he blames Tiresias with a single-handed killing of Laius. Well, Tiresias is not happy to be accused of murder, and at page 402, in a big moment, I mean, the whole play just rocks around, he looks at Oedipus and says, all right, I will tell you, it was you. See, I was trying to shut up, but you got me angry, right? You blame me. You are the curse, the corruption of the land, he tells Oedipus. And then he predicts, and this is beautiful, at line 430, he predicts that Apollo will make Oedipus only very slowly discover the truth, because he's not going to believe Tiresias. It'll have to be worked. He's going to drag out the discovery. Well, that delay and dragging out is, in fact, the definition of the plot of the play. Right? Well, we're going to watch Oedipus slowly put the pieces together. And it's a wonderful sort of meta-criticism of the play. You know, a drama is an artificial structure, an artificial plot. to get to this point, but there's a point to it because we want to watch the effect, right? So that's line 530. Well, Oedipus instantly whips around and says, it must be Creon. What? I mean, Tiresias has just blamed Oedipus, and Oedipus' reaction is to blame someone else. Right? So kind of losing our sympathy a little bit. He blames Creon. They said, yeah, you know, okay, maybe it isn't you, Tiresias. He sort of, the guy's very jumpy, right? He's not making a lot, maybe he's not making full sense, but his mind is darting. Okay, I grilled Tiresias. He sort of passed the exam. I got to go on to some other obviously guilty people. He goes right to Creon, and he says, and I think the reason Creon Tiresias is lying. He's blaming me, you see, but who put him up to it? Who put him up to it? Must have been Creon. And why? Because Creon is envious of me, because I'm married to his sister. And he doesn't get to be king of Thebes. I'm king of Thebes. That guy hates me. Right? Oh, there's a plot. There's a conspiracy against me. Right? Well, so he blames Creon. And he then starts, Oedipus starts rehashing the past to find signs of the plot. He says, I can see it. It was all from the beginning. Tiresias, you're so smart. Well, how come you couldn't figure out the riddle of the Sphinx? You lured me in. You see? Well, this is obviously nonsense. But the conspiracy theories are very attractive, like this, when you're under pressure and you've been accused. Well, Tiresias turns right around and says, at line 433, well, you think you're so smart for solving the riddle of the Sphinx, what goes on full legs more. You can't even figure out who your real parents are, Oedipus. That's how smart you are. Right? And that's a really good point, okay? He thinks he's so smart, and he's not. It strikes me as exactly like Joseph, who's so clever. But at the end of the day, everybody's enslaved in Egypt, okay? And here Oedipus is so clever, he can solve the riddle of the Sphinx, but he can't even figure out who his own parents are or whether he should figure it out, okay? Well, finally, at 524, line 524, Tiresias prophesies that, in fact, the stranger, who he said, will be, in fact, a native Theban. And he will be a man who is blind, though he now has eyes. And he will be a beggar, though now he is rich. And he will be guilty of incest with his mother. Solve that, he says, at line 524. Well, it's like the 12 sheaves at this point. It's like, I think that's my brother's. The seven, it's like really obvious, but to us. But it's not obvious to Oedipus. But then the curse of slow discovery has been put on him, right? Well, the chorus, too, and we go to the second chorus here, can't figure out who the murderer is. This is 955 that you want to mark. Well, you can see that whole chorus going on page 625. And what they're yakking about is they too can't figure out who the murderer is, but they picture him stalking among the rocks in the caves, pursued by the voice from Delphi. And the chorus worries maybe there'll be a blood feud, between Corinth and Thebes when this guy is discovered, if they discover the man's actually a Theban, just pictures all this mess, right? Well, Creon, jumping to line 622, comes in, and you notice how the play just moves pretty schematically. Oedipus comes at the beginning, the chorus comes in, Creon comes in, Tiresias comes in, Creon comes back. All right, it's not like complicated blocking or anything. Right? Oedipus blames Creon for having for telling Oedipus to send for Tiresias. That's part of it. It was obviously part of Creon's plot to get Oedipus. Okay. And he blames Creon for not having investigated the murder of Laius before Oedipus arrived in the city originally. Ah, more obvious steps in the plot against me. Okay. Creon turns around and attacks Oedipus' theory that he's envious. This is line 654. Why would I do these things to you? Why would I plot against you, says Creon? Why would I be envious of you? I'm number two. And it's so much better being number two than number one. I can fool around. Nobody pays attention to me. I can pretend I'm Darth Vader. Okay. Being number one is such a drag. Okay. Always be number two, says Creon. That's pretty powerful stuff because, in other words, he's free from the cares of rule. So he suggests that Oedipus go to Delphi himself and find out the truth. If he's accusing Creon of having brought the wrong message back from Delphi, go yourself. Oedipus says, can't do it, don't have time. Right? Sort of makes an excuse for himself. And I think that's a key action here. As I try and look for what does Oedipus do in this play? Well, he makes up an excuse for why he's right, right? And he doesn't follow good advice. Claims that he doesn't have time to find the truth. This is line 695. He doesn't have time to find the truth when he's under attack. Okay. People are coming after me. I can't take off and go to Delphi. Jocasta comes in and tells the two of them to stop their bickering. Tells Oedipus and Creon to stop bickering. And the chorus takes her side. And they ask Oedipus to please believe that Creon is innocent and not to banish Creon to protect himself. And Oedipus, at line 744, he agrees to spare Creon. So he doesn't lose our sympathy. But he listens to the arguments. We'll see Creon do the exact same thing in the Antigone. Okay, but the inertia's setting up. Right? They've already got their problems. When Jocasta then asks, how would Creon know who killed Laius anyway? And Oedipus said, well, you know, I don't know. In fact, he'd made up the whole notion that Creon knew who killed Laius. He says, that's what Tiresias said. You know, Tiresias is a prophet, and he said this is what happened. And this is about line 775. This is going on, which is, just put a question mark there. The translation is weird, and it's hard to follow. But basically what's going on is that Oedipus is believing in the prophecy, and Jocasta takes the other side and says, never believe in these silly prophets. They're always wrong, and I'll prove it to you. This 775. Just kind of put a question mark there. The next thing is the next line I'm going for is 789. Jocasta is going to prove that oracles are wrong, so she tells the story that Oedipus didn't know of how she and Laius had heard a prophecy that their son would murder the king. But she says, but of course he never did. Because he was a baby, so we exposed him, threw him out on the mountain, and he died. He couldn't possibly have murdered the king. So all prophecies are therefore wrong, says Jocasta. Okay. Plus, the king was killed by strangers, plural, not a stranger or thief, singular. Okay, that's 789, and the cast-out baby is at line 792. Okay. Now, this is really fascinating because it fits my definition of a tragedy. Jocasta is trying to do the right thing, isn't she? She's soothing Oedipus. All her intentions are correct. This is exactly like the friar Romeo and Juliet. He's going to fix things up by marrying Romeo and Juliet. Solve the Montague-Capulet feud with a happy marriage. And, of course, they both die. Trying to do the right thing, the wrong thing happens. That's tragedy, when you're trying to do the right thing. So here the pattern fits, not just Oedipus, but Jocasta too. In fact, it tends to fit everybody in these tragedies. That's the pattern. The best intentions, the best goodwill, clunk. Okay. Gets you in big trouble. Well, Oedipus, dimly, remember, because he's been sort of cursed by Tiresias to do things slowly. Look at line 805. He starts to dimly perceive himself in the pattern of the story Jocasta tells. And it takes him a long time to figure out that he, you know, don't forget, he heard that he was going to kill his parents. And now Jocasta telling a story about, well, we had a son that was prophesied going to kill his parents, his father. Two plus two. That prophecy is an awful lot like this prophecy. Two plus two equals five? Six? I never was very good at math. And it takes him a while to put together the what two plus two equals. And the reason he doesn't do it is there's still this discrepancy between the thief and the thieves. If it was thieves, then 2 plus 2 does not equal 4. And Oedipus is innocent. Right? Anyway, all of this is in slow motion. Since he must know if you think logically, he must know right away that he killed a man at Phocas. And, you know, it's probably, how many guys got murdered at that crossroads? You know, is it like 26 and 52 out here? People die every day? So, I don't know. And I say the phrase I'm using is he's grasping at straws. You know that? I have no idea where that phrase comes from, but you know, it means you're hoping desperately for what you know isn't true. So he's grasping at straws that it was thieves and not a thief. So the issue becomes for him sorting out all the servants and shepherds and messengers and herdsmen. Okay. I want to grill the guy instead of saying, gee, there's two ways you can go here. And the way he goes is, well, I better sort out all these messengers and herdsmen and everything, get this story straight. The other thing is, well, if I did kill Elias, that means I'm sleeping with his wife, and that's my mother. And he doesn't go down that route. And Freud says, ah, don't you see? Proof of the theory of infantile sexuality and, you know, repression and everything else. You see, Oedipus, it's too horrible to think about, just like we all have these horrible desires in us, right, that come out in little odd tics and personality quirks, psychoses, neuroses, and the whole shebang that you learn about in psychology class, and I'm not an expert in, but you can see Freud going, you know, this is great stuff, right? Because Oedipus doesn't face instantly the incest issue. If he had, he would have said, well, if it does prove out to be thief and not thieves, and that would show I'm actually sleeping with my mother, I think I will just avoid the whole issue and go back to bed. You know? Do what my wife says and, like, drop it. You know, there's some things you don't need to tell everybody, right? Well, it comes out, line 835, Jocasta said that he wants to know where is messenger number one, because he can tell him whether it's a thief or thieves. He was the witness, remember, to the murder. He came back saying it was thieves, but like Oedipus is starting to suspect it was thief singular. Where is this guy? And Jocasta says, well, that guy, he was Laius's attendant, that messenger number one. And when he came back and found Oedipus on the throne, this is line 835, he freaked out completely and asked to be made a shepherd. So he's off in the mountains somewhere. Okay. But clearly it's the second time he's been in those mountains, because he had to earlier have carried the baby there. Right, so he knows those hills. And that's where he goes to get away, because he came back and he realized the murderer of Laius was sitting in the throne and married to his wife, and he shut his mouth and he took off to the mountains. But Oedipus has demanded that he be brought back, so the word goes out, bring back that shepherd, who's actually not a shepherd, he's Laius's right-hand man, messenger number one. That's pretty freaky. Okay, that's a revelation. And then Oedipus tells his story to Jocasta, how he got to Thebes in the first place. This is line 858. He was sitting around at home when a drunk stood up and said that Oedipus was not the son of Polybus and Merope of Corinth. Okay. And he told, he went to Delphi to get the news on that. And Apollo, instead of like straightening him out, really, told him that he would sleep with his mother and kill his father. That's line 873. See the quotes. You are fated to couple with your mother. You will bring a breed of children into the light no man can bear to see. Because it'd be your children on your half. Brothers and sisters. Okay. Well, see, Apollo didn't really answer the question. He gave him the same prophecy. Apollo's a nasty old god. And Oedipus doesn't put two and two together that, anyway, he leaves home and he's very angry at the whole thing, and he gets to the crossroads and this jerk gets in his way at line 885, and Oedipus kills him. And that, of course, that guy is his father. Now, the play proceeds as Oedipus is overlooking things just as he did before, when it never occurred to him that his own murder was related to the murder of Laius, just as now he doesn't relate his murder of Laius to Apollo's oracle. Bear with me. What he's afraid of is not that he's sleeping with his mother, but that he, a murderer of the king, is sleeping with the king's wife. His bloody hands, you see, have touched the wife of the man he killed. That's freaking him out. But that's kind of small potatoes compared to what's actually going on, which is he's sleeping with his mother. But it's enough to get him worried and want to pursue the issue, right? So he thinks he needs to exile himself. This is line 915. So he can avoid both Thebes and Corinth. He's just really messy. 915. Still he insists that the shepherd holds the answer. This all may be hypothetical. Maybe my hands aren't bloody, let alone the problem of sleeping with the mother. That's not even coming up. So at 932, he goes right to the main point again. That the issue is thief or thieves. You said thieves. All right, see that line? You want to notice. I think you all get the point by this time. I think this is so interesting because tragedy turns on a feather here. I mean, it really is. I mean, if it was thieves, life is happy. Bring out the wine. Let's get drunk. Let's have fun. If it's thief, everything is lost. And we're all in that situation. Like car accidents are always like that. See, I would have missed. Didn't, you know. So life is turns on a feather. Well, Jocasta doesn't put two together. She still insists Apollo is wrong, even as she proves that he's right. Let's not. Line 1000, we get the chorus again. They're, again, cryptic sayings. The point is, they praise the law. This is line 955. Destiny always guide me. Destiny find me filled with reverence, pure in word and deed. Great laws tower above us. What the connection is between destiny and the law is very murky to me. Okay, but it seems to be the law of destiny. That as far as the chorus is concerned, They take a very simple-minded view of the whole thing. Well, if he winds up in trouble, it was all his fault to begin with. Or he was just fated to be in trouble. But the play is showing just the opposite, that it's a series of decisions by Oedipus, of actual acts, often well-intentioned, that get him into trouble. And that's what makes this a great play. Right? And the chorus is really kind of wrong here. At 982, they say that the... any proud man will finally feel the thunderbolts of the gods, and that's pretty true. Oedipus gets in, he's very proud, and he will feel those thunderbolts. Right? Still, at line 1003, Jocasta thinks the prophecies are hollow and everything's going to come out okay when in comes messenger number 2 from Corinth. With the great news, joy, 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 everything's going to be fine, that Polybus is dead and Oedipus is going to be king of Corinth. So Jocasta is overjoyed because Oedipus, remember, left home. Oedipus told Jocasta he left home so he wouldn't kill his father, but now his father's dead, the guy they think is his father, and of course Oedipus has been in Thebes the whole time, and so he couldn't do it. More proof for Jocasta that these prophecies are a bunch of junk. Okay. At line 1055, Oedipus is pretty happy too for a minute. This is the counterstroke, the way a plot's set up. Everything's looking bad. We're not in a five-act structure, but eventually they turn these into five-act structures. Everything's going downhill for three acts. Then in the fourth act, everything looks good, and then in the fifth act, clunk. Right? So we call this the counterstroke at this point, this sort of moment of happiness before the final disaster. And Oedipus talks about disrespecting the auguries of birds at line 1055. So based on the death of Polybus, Jocasta tells Oedipus he has no need to worry about the father murder prophecy. And then he says, and on the other half of that prophecy, so look, because your father's dead, and you didn't murder him. And the other half of that thing, you know, about sleeping with your mother, wow, that is the biggest Apollo nonsense I ever heard, says Jocasta. All men dream of sleeping with their mothers. And Freud's going, I love it. Okay, that's the basis of infantile sexuality in the Oedipus complex, right? Which here is just a kind of plot device, and Freud makes it a psychological truth, and the psychologists have, don't buy it quite so much as they used to. But there's, it's a nice way of thinking. All boys think of sleeping with a mother. American figures, I never did. I don't know about you guys. That's not the last thing I ever thought of. You denied it. Okay, that means, in a Freudian system, what you deny is the truth. Okay. Anyway, the messenger, hearing all this, and that Oedipus was afraid to go home, blurts out, that, you mean you were afraid of killing your father Polybus, says the messenger? Hey, you weren't his kid. You didn't have anything to worry about all those years. It wasn't only the drunk who knew this. This messenger knows it. And how does the messenger know this? The drunk probably guessed. This is the crucial fact, one of the crucial facts. How does he know it? Because, he says, in a previous lifetime, I used to be a shepherd. And I received this baby from this other shepherd. And I brought it to court. So I happen to know that you were not their king. Freaky. And see, this is recognition and reversal. We were going so well, and now it's starting to fall apart. Okay. Aristotle said, no one has ever constructed a plot like this. This is unbelievable stuff. Okay. You can watch Friends from now till doomsday. They just don't get this kind of plot. Okay. That's the intellectual side. Well, so he was shepherd number two, and he received so the issue becomes, what did shepherd number one know? And Oedipus says, we got to get shepherd number one in here. And they say, and the leader of the corps says, no problem. You've already asked for him when you asked for messenger number one. They're the same guy. Okay? So Oedipus, looking for the truth, having sent for messenger number one, inadvertently has asked for shepherd number one, and he will confirm this story of shepherd number two. Again, we're hanging on a feather, like grasping at straws. Maybe this guy's lying. But shepherd number one will confirm if it's true. And Jocasta's saying, don't bring in shepherd number one. Because she knows damn well who shepherd number one is. Right? Because she knew she gave the baby to the ex-messenger. Right? And she's saying, stop. And she's freaking out completely. This is line 1162. 1162. So she's put together the truth of the story before Oedipus does. Stop searching, she says. But Oedipus says he just wants to learn the secret of his birth. And she's saying, drop it, Jack. It ain't worth it. But he insists on it, and at line 1179, she runs out screaming. He says, well, you know what she's worried about? She thinks I'll find out I'm just a commoner. I was just some little nobody ex-slave's kid, you know. And she'll find out she's married to a commoner. So he keeps pursuing it because he hasn't put two to two together that the real issue is that he's Jocasta's kid, right? So she runs out screaming. The chorus then comes in to sing about the possibility that Oedipus is the child of a god, and this is where you can get good and lost. But that's, you know, abandoned babies who are often said that girls came home pregnant and they said, who did that? Oh, Apollo. He's the father. I was just lying there in the woods. I wouldn't do anything unless God came down. That's it. Okay. That's the theme of Ovid's Metamorphoses, by the way, which we're going to get to. Well, of course, he's grasping at straws, hoping that Oedipus is the child of the god. Anyway, Oedipus has messenger number two confirmed that he is the shepherd, that the shepherd is the man who gave him the baby. These two were together for three seasons on Mount Cithaeron, his Brokeback Mountain plot, where they knew each other very well. So there's shepherd number one confirms that he gave the other one a baby. That's line 1272. It's all falling into place. Everybody's telling the truth. And he says at 1290, and in fact the baby he gave to shepherd number two was the baby he received from Jocasta. And I don't know how many babies she was dumping on the mountain, but I think it was only one. Okay, and it all comes out slowly. Okay. And he admits at line 1305 that they wanted to kill the baby to because of the prophecy, but he felt sorry for it and saved its life, 1305. 1310 is the key to the whole play. Oedipus recognizes who he is. 1310. Chorus chants. This is a great time for the chorus to chant. All joys are just dreams. Even the great, you can't defeat time. Nobody's happy till he's dead. And all this stuff, a lot of action takes place off stage. What happens off stage? Line 1364, news comes that Jocasta has hanged herself. 1364. Why did she hang herself? Well, Oedipus is going, he went in there going mad. She ran off first, he ran after her. The implication of this translation is she freaked out that he was going to murder her. You know, blame the woman. So she hung herself first. But maybe it was a sort of, you know, a suicide because she knew she was tainted from what went on. But it's not clear why he should blame her at all. That's line 1385. But she hung herself. And it's not clear he does blame her, but he takes her pins, the woman's brooches that hold her gown together, with these pins, and he uses those to put out his eyes. That's line 1405. Okay. And the whole point is he's making a symbolic statement himself that the irony of his blindness is that he now knows the truth. And then the question is, was this his destiny or his own action that caused him to do this? Well, he confuses destiny with darkness at line 1415, but at 1450, excuse me, he confuses destiny with darkness. But at 1470, I think another key line, Oedipus makes it very clear that he doesn't confuse Apollo's prediction with his own actions. So he takes the blame himself. Even though it was a prediction, remember, Apollo is a very untrustworthy god and all the predictions are ambiguous and stuff. Okay. He then curses those two shepherds in line 1485. Okay. Which is a little weird. And he comes in and he explains to everybody the justness of his self-punishment. Why did he put his eyes? Symbolically, it's because he wanted to show that you know the truth when you're blind, but when you see, you don't know the truth. This is a kind of very religious message. People love this stuff. Because you can't know the truth of the supernatural. But he says, literally, he put them out so that he would not have to look his father in the eyes when he goes down to the underworld after he dies. Which is a really weird theory, but there's nothing weirder than the Greeks' beliefs. In other words, if you're blind here, you'll be blind when you go to the underworld. More convincing is he doesn't want to have to look at his children. Well, that's kind of silly, too, because he didn't think about them. This is bad. But that's what he says. More convincing, then, is in line 1524 that his blindness is a form of oblivion. He's trying to forget the past. So he puts out his eyes. Creon orders him into a dark place away from the sun because abominations like this shouldn't be seen in the light of day. That's 1566. And he sends to Apollo to find out what he should do with Oedipus. Let him live out on the mountain where he was left as a baby, or let him stay in town. The children are brought in, Antigone and Ismene. And the issue of what happens to them comes up. They can never marry. Oedipus asks Oedipus to look after these two poor children. I mean, who's going to want to marry? Their lineage isn't exactly great. Okay, and that seemed to be an important thing at the time. At the end of the play, of course, points out the moral, count no man happy till he's dead. Well, that leaves us 12 minutes for the Antigone, but what the heck. I told you this was like a lot of talking today. Antigone and Ismene are the protagonists. There's actually two other children in the Oedipus family. And they are, there's not just two daughters of Oedipus and Jocasta, there's two sons. And their names are Polynices and Eteocles. And Creon, never wanting to be number one, these guys actually inherit the throne of Thebes when they grow up. So this play takes place later. All right, the Antigone takes place later. And the myth is a myth of fraternal strife. You're two brothers who cannot get along. I think they're vaguely twins. So the question is, which one's going to rule? And you have a Jacob and Esau situation or Cain and Abel, but this is the Greek version of it. Right? And the Bible is always coming out in favor of the younger son for various reasons. The Greek myth really is making the point that it's really, you need laws to solve these issues because you can't allow people to start bickering among themselves because they'll never solve anything. Well, they can't decide who's going to rule Thebes, so they come to an agreement, which seems perfectly rational, that they'll just take turns. And I think they flip for it, and Eteocles gets the first year. He gets to rule Thebes, and then he's supposed to leave power and let Polynices come in and rule Thebes for the second year, and then Polynices will go take a vacation. So they'll just go back and forth. Well, what happens is Eteocles comes in and decides he doesn't want to leave, and since he's boss, nobody can make him. So he drives his brother, Polynices, into exile. Right? So he seems wrong. But he's got lots of good arguments for that. And you can read all about him in a Roman play, a Roman epic by a guy named Statius, called the Thebaid. Now, this isn't in this play, but it's kind of interesting. He said, well, you know, once I'm in power, you see, people are working for me. If you bring in somebody else, you get factions. Nobody knows who to pay any attention to. It's just all confusion. Better I stay boss. Okay? Polynices goes away. He's so angry, he enlists the six other guys to help him. That's the seven against Thebes. They come back and they fight. And in the nature of things, Polynices, there's seven champions on the Theban side. They meet the seven champions of the, they're actually from Argos, which is another city. And they all pair off, and Polynices meets Eteocles at the seventh gate of Thebes. They fight and they both die. They kill each other right at the same time. So nothing's solved. So who's going to become ruler of Thebes? Well, you know, Creon, of course. He comes out, right? And he says, I don't care who was right and who was wrong in this. We're Thebans, and we don't attack other Thebans. Therefore, the right guy was Eteocles, and the traitor was Polynices. Because that's just the way it goes. You don't attack the homeland. Okay? Docum est pro patria mori. Sweet it is to die for the fatherland. Right? We don't. So he gets a burial with all the honors. But Polynices, he can just lie in the dust and rot. Right? He can just lie in the dust and rot. And I know people believe that means he can't go to the underworld and his soul won't pass the river Styx. And that's his problem, not mine. Okay? Because in this city, we make traitors pay. Well, Antigone is Polynices' sister. She doesn't like that one bit. She says, we're talking about the guy's eternal soul here. It doesn't matter in the large scheme of things who he fought for. We both know there was no right or wrong here. He deserves to be buried properly. And she goes out, and all it takes is like a handful of dust thrown on his corpse and a mumbling something, right? So she, in the name of the larger law, buries her brother, even just sprinkling dust on him. And Creon is furious because this is, when he finds out, this is a direct challenge to his authority. And that's what the play is about. In one sense, this conflict between local law, the law made by men and society, and higher moral laws, which, believe it or not, can conflict. Okay. All right. Now, the play is really kind of about Creon. Antigone sticks to her guns right through the whole thing. And she's warned, and she goes back and does it again. Okay, and you get an opening conversation, and there's sort of bickering among the sisters because Ismene is kind of wimpy and won't help. But eventually, she sort of comes down on Antigone's side. But Creon is furious and determined to punish Antigone, so he has her arrested, right, and put into a cave or a some kind of closed building for disobeying him. He's not gonna kill her himself, but he locks her away and says she can decide whether to live or die in there. I wash my hands of the whole affair. Right? It's not my responsibility, says Creon. Right? And then the problem is, because he's the big leader and he can't be made to look bad. The problem is, there's this guy named Haman, right? Who is the son of Creon. And guess what? Was engaged to Antigone. So he is not too happy with Dad for locking away his intended bride. And especially on a charge like this. He says, Dad, you know, I can see your point. You make kind of good point. That you've got to be respected. Okay? But can't we sort of ease up a little bit? Find a little compromise? Well, he locks her away. And and then you get this, the timing goes two ways. And a really freaky thing happens, since I'm going to do the short one. I'll just give you one. Line 843, just mark that one. Hyman says to his father, if you don't let her go, somebody's going to die. If you don't let her go, somebody's going to die. And Creon figures it's a threat against him, Creon, that his son's going to kill him. But it turns out, see, everything's misheard in these Greek tragedies. Hyman's actually threatening to kill himself if his father doesn't relent. Okay? And in fact, he does. So Creon, trying to do the right thing, actually does the very worst thing, because his son commits suicide. And when his wife finds out that her son has committed suicide, she kills herself. So he's lost his wife and his son over his obstinate foolhardiness. And the worst part is that everybody had been trying to get Creon to change his mind, and at line 1225, having sent his son off furious, locked up Antigone, the people are still reasoning with Creon, and he says, you know, I think you're right. I was wrong. I'm really sorry. I got to tell my son I was wrong, and, you know, somebody sinned for Antigone, and let her go. And they go to Antigone, and she's already hung herself. And Hymen is dead at her feet, having killed himself in despair, because Antigone's dead. And Creon's too late. And that's that timing issue. It's a whole new definition of tragedy. Very important for something like Hamlet or something like that. You know, it's not enough to do the right thing. You got to do it in time. Weird. Sassy on Tuesday. Have a wild weekend.